What happened there? Okay. All right. So on the mock exam, first question is outline and briefly describe. So I'm going to call it slowly, just give you, those of you that don't have it, a chance to take it down. So outline and briefly describe the primary sources of law in Ireland. Okay. So that's question one. That's the first part of question one. That's worth 10 marks. Okay. So what I'll do is I'll tell you. So there's four things we're looking for that question. Okay. All right. First one is common law and judicial precedent. Okay. So this comes from module one. Okay. So it's common law and judicial precedent. Okay. Second one we're looking for is the Irish Constitution. Okay, so that's the second source of Irish law. Third one is statutory legislation. And then the last one is European Union law. Okay, so go into a bit of detail, that's what we're looking for in each of those, but those are basically the four parts of the answer that we're looking for. Okay, so there's 10 marks on this, and there's a total 20 marks on the two of them. Okay. So basically you should allocate half your time, so 15 minutes should be allocated to this actual section, okay? Just before I forget, just in case I don't call it out at the end, so the way the marking system works is there's 70 marks for the exam, okay? Alright, so the exam will ultimately be, it actually adds up to 80 marks on it, but it will ultimately translate to 70%, okay? Out of the remaining 30%, 10 will be allocated for your contract law assignment. 10 will be allocated for your tort assignment, and then the other 10 marks will be allocated for the multiple choices questions that you've done. Okay, all right. So in terms of that question, returning to that question. So first part is common law and judicial precedent. Okay, so I mean your answer there is basically saying, okay, from 1800 until the Constitution was the first Constitution was signed, the laws of Ireland came from Westminster. Okay, all right. So and a common law system and judicial precedent began. So it began from 1800. Okay, you need to bring equity into it. Okay, there was a discussion of equity in the notes. Okay, so that basically means okay, up until equity started. Basically, the law was the law, whether it was fair or not. That was the case. When equity came in, it began to start bringing an element of fairness into the actual law. Okay, so it would look at the various facts that surrounded a case, and then judgment would be delivered that way. Okay. Precedent means the application of the principle of law is laid down by a higher court on a previous occasion and needs to be respected by that court. Okay, so if the same facts, if you have a case in the year 2016 and exactly the same case comes before the court in 2017, if the facts are exactly the same, the expectation is that the same judgment will apply. Okay, and that'll be what the lawyers will argue about in court, and that's ultimately the decision that the judge should probably come to. Okay. If the facts differ slightly from the 2016 case, the 2017 case, the judge will call that out in the judgment that they're giving at the end. Okay, so judicial precedent and common law, that's the first way that we get our laws. Okay, build on one case, builds on the other, and the judges keep looking back to the previous cases. Okay. Second place that we get our laws from is the Irish Constitution. Okay, Irish Constitution came into effect in 1937. Constitution regulates the structure and function of the principal organs of government, so it decides how the government's going to work, guarantees certain rights, personal rights under Article 30, rights of the family under Article 41, rights to education under Article 42, and so on. Okay? And a key thing to point out in relation to the Constitution is it can only be changed by referendum. Okay? Referendum means change can only apply when 51% or more vote in favour of a change. Third form of law is statutory legislation. Okay, so the first one is superior legislation. Okay, so it's two types: the superior legislation and subordinate legislation. Okay, superior legislation is enacted by the legislator. Okay, so a bill is submitted for a purpose of being passed into law. It goes through five stages of the Oireachtas. Taoiseach then brings the bill to the President to be signed. Once both houses of the Oireachtas have passed the bill, President can either sign the bill or decline to sign the bill. In the case that they decline to sign the bill, the President will consult with the Council of State and will refer to the Supreme Court. Okay? So that's for superior legislation. Okay, so that's the more important laws that we have in our country. In terms of the more minor ones, that's what's known as subordinate legislation. Okay, so the Oireachtas and the Parliament have delegated the powers to local authorities and other bodies, and they make these laws. So these are laws such as minor traffic offences, littering, things like that. Okay. And finally, you have EU law. Okay, so Ireland became a member of the what was the EEC at the time in 1973, after they had a referendum to decide on whether or not to join in 1972. So it then became a case that EU law is now part of the laws that we govern. Okay, that we have in the country. Okay, similar to our national laws, EU law comes into this primary legislation, which is the more important ones, and then the secondary legislation. Okay, primary legislation is basically the treaties. Okay, it guarantees the right freedom of movement, freedom of service, freedom of capital, and so on. Okay, so it's the treaties themselves. Okay, and then the secondary legislation, which is basically the changing things that go on a regular basis in the EU, introduction of regulations, directives, decisions, recommendations, and opinions. Okay, so citizens of the EU will be bound by these decisions when they're made. Okay, so that basically is the first part of the first question. Okay, so those are the four things we're looking for. Okay. In terms of length, I mean, so length will vary depending on how fast you can potentially write, but I suppose in terms of those four things, you'd probably expect to do a page, maybe a page and a bit between to cover those four things off. Okay?
And dates are key,
aren't
they?
Are dates key? Nosh. If you know them, put them in. If they're wrong, I'm going to read past it. You know, so don't worry about it. If you know them, put them in. Okay? So, in terms of the second question, the second part of the first question is again to worth 10 marks. So, you'd be allocating if you choose to do this question, you'd be allocating 15 minutes to do that. This question is: outline the principal differences between civil law and criminal law in Ireland. Okay, outline the principal differences between civil law and criminal law in Ireland. Okay, so what are those differences? Okay, civil proceedings are initiated by private individuals or companies. Okay, criminal proceedings are commenced by the state. Okay, somebody does something wrong, criminal proceedings are always the state versus Murphy, the state versus Daly, state versus Smith. So it's the state that takes the case. Okay, in civil proceedings, private individuals or companies take the case. Okay. Some categories of civil law: contract, which you've done an assignment on; tort, which you've done an assignment on; commercial law, which is covered off in the notes; and employment law. Okay, those are examples of civil law. Okay, so if there's a case about it, it doesn't mean anybody's going to prison, but it does mean there's a dispute. Okay. What are some of the principal differences? In civil cases, you have a plaintiff and you have a defendant. Okay. In criminal cases, as I said, it's the state that take the case on behalf of the people of Ireland, saying so-and-so has broken a criminal law. In civil law, the burden of proof it moves depending on the case. You know, so in some cases, the judge will insist that the plaintiff proves their case. In other cases, the judge may insist that it's up to the defendant to really, really prove their case. Okay. In civil law, the standard of proof. That's in civil law. So. In criminal law, it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt. Okay, all right, so you're not going to be convicted in criminal law unless the judge or the jury is absolutely certain that you did it. Okay, it's not enough to be sort of sure; they have to be pretty much 100% sure that you're guilty. Okay, so 51% would be enough to win a civil case or lose a civil case. You're probably talking 90 to 100% certainty. In the case of a criminal case. Okay, in civil law, if you win a civil law case, what can you expect to get? You might get damages, you might get an injunction against the other party, you might get specific performance, so that forces the other party to deliver on the contract, or you might get rescission on the contract, it might get you out of a contract that you don't want to be in. Okay, if you win, that's what you're likely to get. Okay, in criminal law, if you lose, what are you likely to be facing? You could face imprisonment, you could face a fine, you could face community service, or if you're lucky, you might just be bound to the peace. Okay, so that's basically what we're looking for in the second part of question one. Any questions on any of that? Okay. So we'll allocate kind of 10-15 minutes at the end where we'll go through the real paper, and we'll do comparisons with it, between it and the mock one. Okay. All right. So question two. Question two is a two-parter. Okay. So there's 12 marks available for part A, and there's 8 marks available for part B. So that basically means if you do your rough maths, you should probably spend about 18 minutes on part A and about 12 minutes on part B. Okay. So part A is describe how common law has evolved and explain how it is applied in the court system in Ireland today. Okay. So, in terms of answering that question, so it's a little bit like a bit of a history kind of, that's kind of a history type question, if you like, okay? So, in terms of the main points we'd be looking for, is that prior to the arrival of the Normans in Ireland in 1171, Ireland was governed mainly by a system of custom known as Brehon law, okay? So it was administered and managed by judicial figures known as Brehons, who were the equivalent of judges at the time, okay? From 1171 to 1600, when the following the arrival of the Anglo-Normans, there was conflict in Ireland between common law system and Brehon law system. Okay, so the Anglo-Normans, when they arrived, brought the common law system, which was already in existence over in England, they brought it across, and so there was conflict between which prevailed. Okay, from 1600, when the Irish chieftains were defeated at the Battle of Kinsale. Okay, so again on the dates, you know, I'll be flexible on these dates. Okay, I mean you don't need to worry too much about them. Okay, but from 1600, when the Irish chieftains were defeated in the Battle of Kinsale, Brehon law was more or less extinct, and it was fully extinct in 1800 when the Act of Union was signed. Okay, so the Act of Union meant that every law that was signed in Westminster was applicable on the people of Ireland. Okay. You need to mention equity, okay? So, you know, from 1800 to kind of 1850 or so, basically the law was the law. But after people started to appeal, the principle of equity came in, so they started looking at whether or not they looked a bit more at the facts of the case to decide whether it was fair that the law should apply in one case or another, okay? So equity needs to be discussed again as part of this answer, okay? All right. So that's one part of it. The second thing that I would cover off in this part of the answer is judicial precedent. Okay, so we covered judicial precedent a few minutes ago, but in terms of what we're looking for, I mean, again, it's a case. Okay, if a higher court says that this is the way the law is interpreted, if a year later or 2 years later there's a case which is exactly the same, the expectation would be that the same judgment would occur. Okay, unless there's a difference in facts. Okay. So in terms of how it's applied to the courts today, what do we still have? We have common law, okay? So that means that when cases happen, we pay attention to them. We have the principle of equity, okay? So equity is taken into consideration. Is it a fair decision or is it not a fair decision based on the facts of the case? And then finally, you have the case, you have the example of judicial precedent, okay? All right. So on that one, the question is, that basically is the principle. If it happened before, the same rule applies. Okay, so those are the things that have survived from the history of the law up to today. Okay. Any questions on any of that? Okay.
Do you have to discuss judicial precedent and common law there, even though we have to discuss it in the first part? Yeah.
You may or may not decide to do. You mean you might decide to skip both these questions, or you might decide to do both. Would you discuss them again? Yeah. Well, let me see. I mean, it's a fair question. So, I mean, I can't go back to previous answers and kind of bring points from them. Nice and all as it'd be. From question one into question two, but if you would put probably more detail in it in question two than you would in question one. So I mean, in question one, I mean, like I said, it's half the question. Judicial precedent is maybe a quarter of that half the question, so you'd be only looking at kind of putting that much in. In the second one, you're probably putting maybe a paragraph or maybe even a bit more into it. Okay. But yeah, it's a fair question. I mean, I'll be looking at the real one in a little while. I don't think that scenario occurs. But yeah, there's certainly a case. But you know, it can be nice if you study one thing and you can get two questions out of it. So there is an element of that in the real exam. So part two of question two. The question is: explain the system of courts in the Irish civil court system. Okay, nice question. Okay. So, what are the courts that we have? Okay. So we have, at its lowest level, we have the district court. Okay. So district court handles the lowest level of cases. Okay, and you have about 60 district court judges in the country at any one time. All right. And the country is broken into 23 different regions. Okay, and they deal with anything up to a value of 15,000. Okay, if the court case is worth up to 15,000. Then that will be held in the district court. Okay, if it crosses over beyond 15,000, it moves up to the circuit court. Okay, all right. So it deals with minor things, motor offences, where the defendant is not entitled to a trial by jury. It's just a judge, and then the maximum penalty that you can get if you are convicted of a criminal offence in the district court is 12 months in prison. So that's the type of thing the district court deals with. Okay. Then you move up to the circuit court. Okay, you have 37 circuit court judges at any one time. And in this occasion, the country is broken into 8 different jurisdictions. Okay, civil jurisdiction is limited to, so civil jurisdiction in the circuit court is limited to 75,000. Okay, 75,000. Okay, so they can hear appeals from the district court, and or if the value is up to 75,000, it'll be heard in the circuit court. Okay, then you move on to the High Court. All right. The jurisdiction of the High Court can cover both criminal and civil matters. Okay, so sometimes you hear about trials in the High Court which are criminal. Sometimes you hear about cases in the High Court which are civil matters. They're not criminal at all. Okay, you have 35 judges at High Court level. Okay, there's the President of the High Court, who is also one of the members of the Supreme Court, and you have 35 judges who, I suppose, essentially report to the President of the High Court. Okay. So normally in the High Court you hear the cases are with the judge sitting on their own. Okay, there are occasions, however, where you can have 3 judges sitting together. Okay, juries may be used in the High Court for civil cases. They'll certainly be used for the majority of criminal cases. Okay, when the High Court is hearing a criminal case, it's known as the Central Criminal Court. Okay, but that's only for the most serious offences. Only the most serious criminal offences reach the High Court. Okay, then you have the Court of Criminal Appeal. So if anyone wants to appeal a criminal conviction from the Circuit Court, from the Central Criminal Court, or the Special Criminal Court, which has judges alone and no juries, it'll be sent to the Court of Criminal Appeal. 3 judges will hear it. One of the judges will be from the Supreme Court, the other 2 will be from the High Court, and then the court's decision is by majority. If it's ruled as unanimous or a 2-1 verdict, then that'll be the decision that is taken by the Court of Criminal Appeal. Okay? You then have the Supreme Court. Okay, so Supreme Court is the court of last resort in Ireland. So it's for cases that commenced in the High Court. They can be appealed to the Supreme Court. There are 7 Supreme Court judges at any one time, plus the Chief Justice. They will use either 3 or 5 judges on the case. But it is the final right of appeal that you have within the country itself. Okay. And then finally, the European Court of Justice. Okay, so although based outside the state, European Court of Justice nevertheless forms part of the Irish system of courts. This deals with more EU law. Okay, if you're going to the European Court of Justice, it's because you feel that one of your EU rights that is entrenched in the treaties or that has been entrenched in one of the regulations has been broken. That's when you would go to the European Court of Justice, or the ECJ, as it's known as. So that's the court system that we have in Ireland. Okay, so. If you're doing that particular question, because it's 8 marks, you would do 12 minutes on that. Any questions on any of that?
If you answer question A on one question and B on another, can that be counted as 1 out of the 4?
No.
That's the part A and B of
question. Yeah, it needs to be A and B for question 1, A and B for question 2. So no, you can't interchange them. Okay. So question 3, again, it's a two-parter. So question three. So nice, easy, short question. Explain the essential elements of a contract. Okay. 12 marks available on that. Okay. Now I can go through this if you want. It's basically the in terms of what we're looking for. We're looking for offer. We're looking for acceptance. We're looking for consideration. We're looking for intention to create legal relations. But in terms of both groups, you know, you've essentially everyone did that assignment and everyone pretty much nailed that point. So I don't necessarily propose to go over it in too much detail unless anyone has specific concerns about any of them. No? Okay. So move on to question 3B. So question 3, B is, sorry, I'm just finding it here. Where is it? So question 3B, the question is, explain what is meant by terms of a contract and give examples, okay? So this part I will go through because we didn't have a specific assignment on it, okay? So terms of a contract. So terms of a contract, they basically fall into two categories. They're either expressed or implied, okay? So expressed terms are fairly straightforward because they're in the contract, okay? If you're buying a house, for instance, it's very unlikely there's going to be a contract that says, I will give you a house, okay? It's almost certain because houses vary, all right? So it's almost certain that very early on in the contract, we call out, the house that I'm going to give you is 10 Main Road, Dundalk, okay? That's going to be in the contract very early, okay? It's expressed term, okay? Now, an implied term would be, are those implied by the law through common law, statute, custom, constitution, okay? So an implied term, which may not necessarily be in the contract. Now, I think with houses maybe are not the best example because you get a bit finicky in houses, but I suppose let's take a car, for instance, because, okay, you're not going to spend as much money on a car, okay? An implied term, which may not be called, you know, if I come up with a contract to sell you a car, I'd probably put in that the car is, you know, the car is such and such age, it's such and such type of car, okay? An implied term is, I may not necessarily put in the color of the car, all right? Okay, I'm going to give you a car. I need to give you the car that matches the description. May not necessarily go into the color of the car. Okay, a better implied term would be whether or not the car goes. Okay, if I have a contract to sell you a car, unless I specifically call out and say, by the way, the car doesn't go, it's pretty certain. You know, if you're buying the car, the expectation is you stick the key in the ignition and the car moves. All right, okay. So an express term would be what you call out in the actual contract. This is the house I'm selling you. This is the car I'm selling you. An implied term would be something like, okay, does the car go? Because the expectation is that it does go, unless you specifically say otherwise, okay? So not every statement that's made in the... not every express statement will form a contract, okay? People may, as part of their discussions, kind of say, oh, by the way, the car is red, okay? But if it's not called out in the contract, you know, it has been expressed, but if it's not called out in the contract, it may not necessarily be the case, okay? So there's express terms, basically, within express terms, you have two types of express terms, okay? You have conditions and you have warranties, okay? A condition is a vital term of the contract, okay? If the contract says, I'm going to sell you a car, and when you come to collect it, I produce a motorbike is not a car, all right? Okay, if I produce a car, so you're entitled to walk away, okay? So even if I've lost money, I said, well, I'm giving you a motorbike. I said, well, I asked for a car. You agreed to give me a car. You're entitled to walk away, okay? So I don't want the motorbike to walk away. And if the person has lost money because they've gone and bought you a motorbike that they're now selling onto you, that's their problem, okay? So that's a condition, okay? But you also have warranties, okay? So warranty is a minor subsidiary, okay? So if potentially the car is supposed to be red and I give you a blue one, that may be deemed, you know, it could be a decision by the court, but it may well be deemed to be not a massive difference, okay? Or imagine, for instance, I mean, let's take it another level. Let's say I promise to give you a midnight blue, and I give you a different type of blue. The court may well decide, well, it's still a car. You know, essentially, the contract has been fulfilled. Okay, so you got conditions and you got warranties. Okay, conditions are key thing parts of the contract. A warranty is a minor part of the contract. Okay. Okay. So that's express terms. Implied terms, so I mean, we mentioned a moment ago, but I mean, how will implied terms be essentially decided upon? Implied terms are, you know, the general presumption is the parties express either verbally in writing everything that's important, okay? So, I mean, if it's important that you go in the contract, okay? And you should, regardless of whether you're, whichever side of the contract you're on, you should insist on it being there if it's important to you, okay? Contracts are usually long, okay? So everything important should be in there, okay? The court will take that into consideration, okay? If it's not in the contract and there's kind of an implied term, so I mean, for instance, if I give you a car, there's probably an expectation that there may be a roof on it, for instance, okay, unless it's specifically called out, by the way, there's no roof. The court will use what is known as the officious bystanders test. So they'll basically, in theory, you know, they won't do it in practice, but they will basically say, okay, if we stop somebody in the street, we ask them, do you think if I'm selling you a car that it should have a roof on it? And they said yes, and say, okay, fine, that's the decision we're going to go with. All right? So the officious bystander test is what is used to determine are implied terms correct or not. Okay? Okay. So that's basically the answers that you'd be looking to put in for the second part of that question. Okay? Are there any questions on any of that? Okay, there are a couple of cases in there. It might be no harm to put one or two of them in them, okay? Certainly be worth a few extra points, all right? So, question four. Question four is a one-parter, okay? So, you spend the entire 30 minutes answering this one question, okay? And the question is, in relation to company law, explain how a private limited company differs from that of a sole trader, okay? Sorry, I'll give you that again. So in relation to company law, which is module 2, I think, explain how a private limited company differs from that of a sole trader. Okay? There's four things we're looking for here, okay? So you might want to spend, you know, on average about half a page on each of these, okay? So the first one is it's legally separate from its owners, okay? So company and its owners are two separate entities, okay? All right? So, you know, some of the discussions that are there in the notes is, I mean, if you own the company, it doesn't mean you can use every, you know, it doesn't mean you can start taking money out of the company and using it to spend, you know, on your holiday, for instance, okay? If you have no money, but the company has loads of money, you can't kind of help yourself to 5,000 and go on holidays with it if you're one of the directors, okay? Can't be done, all right? Separate entity, okay? It's the company's money, not your money, okay? The only exception is when things start going wrong with the company. So basically, unfortunately, one easy way of looking at it is if it were to be to your benefit, they're two separate entities, okay? If it's to your detriment, as it's called out in the notes, the corporate veil gets lifted and the company and the directors kind of get seen as being one, okay? So if, for instance, the company is involved in reckless trading, okay, or fraudulent trading, okay, a company can't decide to go off and be reckless, okay? It is an entity, but it doesn't have a personality. It's not a person, okay? It can't decide to go off and break the law. The directors have to go off and decide that the company is going to go break the law. So if it's involved in reckless trading, if it's involved in fraudulent trading, then the veil will be lifted and the law will say, okay, well, yes, it was the company that did this, but it did it because the directors are the ones pulling the levers and made the company do this, okay? It's not the company that's going to be prosecuted, it's the directors, okay? Okay, so they're seen as two separate entities. That's the first part, okay? There's limited liability, okay? This is one of the more positive ones if you're one of the directors or if you're founding the company, okay? It's limited liability, okay? If you set up a company and the company fails, there's limited liability, okay? If there's a company car, for instance, the company goes insolvent and there's a company car, people are entitled to use the profit, the proceeds of that company car to discharge the debts of the company, okay? However, you might be the director of the company, you might be driving a lovely 172 Merc that cost you $100,000. They cannot come after the 172 Merc, okay? Belongs to you, doesn't belong to the company, okay? So it's limited liability, okay? And this is to encourage people to set up companies, because ultimately you set up companies, you might create jobs, and you might pay taxes to the state. So it's in the state's interest that companies get set up, okay? So it gives you a chance to succeed or fail, okay? If you are a sole trader, however, you are the company, okay? If you're a solicitor and you put a sign up and said, I'm the solicitor, and you put you are the company, so that is a difference, okay? So sole trader is you and you alone, okay? All right? Company can be two people, three people, four people, can be thousands of people, okay? But there's a difference, okay? When the sole trader dies or retires, chances are the business ends, okay? When Bill Gates has already moved off Microsoft, when he dies, is Microsoft going to end? No. Okay. So limited liability. Okay. Transferable shares. Okay. All right. So if you own part of the company and you choose to retire, you should be able to take that chunk of the company and sell it on to somebody. Okay? You can't really do that if you're a sole trader. Okay? Declan, in many ways, is a sole trader. Okay? Okay? So if you're a sole trader, you can't do that. You are the business. Okay? If you're part of the company, you can take that chunk of the company, you can sell it on to somebody else. Okay? I'm selling you my share in this company because the company is going to go on whether I'm there or not. Okay? And then the final part is continuous existence, which I've already alluded to in my last two bits of answers. Okay? Company will go on forever. Sole traders will not. Okay? So those are the four things. All right? So legally separate from the owners, limited liability, transferable shares, continuous existence. Okay? And that's one part of question, so that covers all of question four in the mock exam. Any questions on any of that? Okay. So question five in the mock exam it's a three-parter. So explain the role of each of the following. Explain the role of each of the following, okay? And the three things that they're asking you to give are company director, excuse me, which is worth 5 marks, an auditor, which is worth 5 marks, and then a liquidator, which is worth 10. So obviously, if you're saying you're doing 2 pages to answer this, 1 page on the liquidator and then a half a page each on the other two. Okay? So, company director. So, the 1990 Act, Companies Act, placed new responsibilities. I mean, what is the role of a director? So basically, the 1990 Act placed new responsibilities on the directors of limited companies in order to ensure that they start registering the company, that they need to file a tax return, they need to file an annual return within a specific time frame with the company's registration office. In exchange for this, companies also have to disclose certain facts. So prior to 1990, people were lending money out to companies and the companies were going bankrupt and people knew nothing about whether or not the company was on its last legs or not, okay? So in order to address this, in 1990, an act was signed which gave extra requirements on the directors, and there were more stringent penalties brought into place for the directors if they failed to do that, okay? So they need to register the company, they need to file annual returns, and there are consequences for them if they don't. Okay, that's basically what the role of a director is. In terms of the auditor, so every company has to appoint an auditor or auditors with the exception of small and medium enterprises, okay? And their principal task is to examine the company's accounts and to make an auditor's report on them, okay? So they're basically, it's a checks and balances system, okay? They have a look at the company's books and they sign off to say, yeah, we think, if they say there's 1 million in assets, we're happy enough they have 1 million in assets. And if they don't, they won't sign the auditor's report, okay? So there's a register of auditors which are kept by the company's registration office. And obviously if you're an auditor and you give false or misleading information, there are financial and potentially criminal penalties which will be enforced upon you. Okay? So that in short is the role of an auditor. Okay? Company director files the returns, auditor reviews them, decides whether or not they agree with them or not, and then signs them off. Okay? And then the more detailed one is the liquidator, okay? So liquidator is defined as a person who conducts a liquidation or a winding up of a company. Once they're appointed, liquidator must notify the registrar of companies who will in turn notify the OCD. Regardless of the type of liquidation, liquidator's general function is the same, which is to liquidate the company. So the principal duties are, one is to take possession of the company's assets and protect them, okay? We mentioned lifting the corporate veil earlier on. You can have scenarios when companies are on the way down that directors start grabbing assets and trying to sell them off and maybe keep the profits, the proceeds for themselves, okay? It happens. Okay, so their job is to get in and take possession of the company's assets and protect them from being sold in a reckless manner. Second one is to make a list of the debtors and creditors of the company, okay? So they need to know how much the company owes and how much they can potentially get in. Third one is to have disputed cases adjudicated by the courts. Okay, so they need to get decisions where they need to get decisions. Step four, sell off the assets of the company. Step five, pay off the debts of the company in order of priority. Okay. Number one in priority is the liquidator themselves to make sure they get paid. Okay. Then it moves on to taxes, employees, and ultimately unsecured creditors. well, secure creditors, then unsecure creditors. Okay? That's what a liquidator is supposed to do. Okay? So you got your company director, you've got your auditor, and you got liquidator, okay? Five marks, 10 marks. Any questions on any of that? No? Okay. So, question 6 is on EU law. Okay? Explain the primary source of law in the European Union and how it is applied to the national courts. Okay, so we mentioned this earlier. EU law falls into two categories. Okay, you have the primary sources of law, and you have the secondary sources of law. Okay, so this is a two-parter. So you probably look to spend about a page on this. So probably half a page on the primary sources, half a page on the secondary sources. Okay, primary sources of the law are the various treaties. Okay, which basically formed the EU. So they range from 1951 up to the Lisbon Treaty in 2009. Okay. But basically, what the EU guarantees is it guarantees free movement of goods, okay? Guarantees free movement of workers, okay? So free movement of goods means you can move good from Dublin to Paris for the same cost of moving it from Dublin to Cork, okay? Free movement of workers means that if you're French and you want to work in Ireland, you can come do that. If you're Irish and want to work in Spain, you can go do that. Free movement of workers, no visas, no requirements, okay? Third one is the right of establishment. Okay, you can set up a company. You should be able to set up a company in France in exactly the same way as you can set up a company in Ireland. And finally, the free movement of services. Okay. Okay, so it means you can do business in France as easily as you can do business in Galway, Dublin, Cork. Okay. Okay, so those are the things that are entrenched in the EU, okay? They come from the various treaties, Treaty of Paris, Treaty of Rome, Single European Act, Maastricht Treaty, Amsterdam, Nice, and Lisbon treaties, okay? Which range from 1951 up to 2009, all right? So those are the primary sources of law. Secondary sources of law are the regulations, okay? So regulations are generally applicable to all of us, okay? So when a regulation is passed into law in the EU, it's immediately applicable upon all of us, okay? So the day after, whatever it is, we have to abide by it, okay? Those are regulations, okay? So they apply. So there's no discussions, no debate, they just apply it upon all the EU citizens universally, okay? Directives are different, nope, okay? Directives, basically, the EU says, okay, this, well, we're going to, a good example of directive is we're going to cut carbon emissions by X. Every country has to cut carbon emissions in half by 2025, okay? But they can leave it up to the states as to how they do it. So, okay, so if you're the state, you can say, okay, we're going to do it by getting rid of cars, we're going to put everybody on bicycles, and they say, okay, yeah, if you want to do it that way, that's the way you do it, okay? If you say no, we're not going to do that. We're going to leave everybody in the cars, but we're going to make all the companies that maybe are polluting the environment responsible for it. Then you can do it that way. So there's an element of the way they do it in Ireland is different to the way they do it in France is different to the way they do it in Germany. So the states themselves decide how they do it, but the general directive, hence the name, is given from the EU. Okay. Then you have decisions and you have recommendations. Okay, decisions are immediately binding, so they're like regulations, but they may not be binding on everybody. Okay, so they're binding on people that they're addressed. So, for instance, you know, if the EU were to make a decision that said, okay, there's going to be the same speed limit on motorways in every one of the EU states, that's fine, but it's only going to be applicable to drivers. Okay, it doesn't apply to every single one of us. Okay, it applies to drivers only. Okay, so if you choose to drive, you'll have to abide by that, okay? So it's a decision, but it's only on a certain portion of the EU population, okay? And then finally, you have recommendations and opinions. So every now and again, the EU will express a recommendation or an opinion. They will say, this is the way we would like the EU to be going, okay? The non-binding, they do put pressure. I mean, example might be that in the past, they have kind of said it'd be nice if every country in the EU had the same corporation tax, for instance. Ireland has said, okay, we hear your recommendation, however, we're not going to do it. So it's a recommendation. Pressure is put on various states to abide by the recommendations, but they're not obliged to do it. It's not a regulation, okay? The reason it's not a regulation is because it is protected in the various treaties that says we are not obliged to do it. Okay? Any questions on any of that? The way that question breaks down, just to be clear, is part A is what are the primary sources of EU law, and part B is what are the secondary sources of EU law. Okay. Okay, not a bad question. Okay, so question 7 is a one-parter. Okay, the good news is we're not going to spend much detail on it. So I'll just read out to you what it is. It's explain each essential element that must be proven by the plaintiff in order to establish negligence, and also discuss the possible defences that the defendant may rely on. Okay, so in short, if you want to shorten it down, what do you need to prove negligence, and what are the defences that you may have? Okay, so I'm not proposing to, again, negligence. You went through in quite a bit of detail in your tort assignments. Okay, and again, you all nailed that. All right, so I'm not proposing. If people were struggling with it, if you are still struggling with it, reach out to me next week or the week after. But I'm not proposing necessarily to go through it because you all clearly understood it from the assignments that I read. Okay? The defences I will go through because that wasn't necessarily called in quite as much detail. Okay? The word defences in the actual negligent misstatement part of the of it, but it wasn't general one. So I'll go through this quickly. Okay? So in terms of defences, so if you're the defendant and it's looking bad for you in the case, what can you potentially rely on, okay? One is contributory negligence, okay? Yes, I did knock the pedestrian down, but the pedestrian walked out right in front of me without looking left or right, okay? Is the pedestrian partly at fault? Maybe, okay? Contributory negligence, okay? That's your first defence. There's a couple of cases in there, so there'd be no harm to mention them, okay? The next one is, it's known in Latin as res ipsa locator, okay? But what it translates to is the facts speak for themselves, okay? As we mentioned earlier on, in criminal cases, you have to be 99 to 100% certain that the person in the dock did it, okay? However, in civil cases such as this, burden of proof shifts a bit, okay? All right, so let the facts speak for themselves, okay? So in some cases, the law will presume that the negligence presumes negligence because the wrongdoer has sole control of the cause of the incident, and because the incident could normally not have happened without some element of carelessness. Okay, so essentially what that means is if it can only be down to the defendant that something happened, then it might well be that the case goes for the plaintiff. However, if the wrongdoer has sole control, and the incident can only have happened without an element of carelessness, then the case is going to fall on the defendant's side. Okay. However, if there's an element of carelessness, so similar to contributory negligence, if there's an element of carelessness on the plaintiff's side, the burden of proof may shift. So it's when the court looks at the case, the facts of the case, they will decide, okay, is the burden of proof with the plaintiff or is the burden of proof with the defendant, okay? Depending on the facts of the case, it may shift, okay? The third one is consent, okay? If you do a parachute jump and you injure yourself during the parachute jump, there will be documents that will be produced by the parachute club to say, okay, well, you signed up, you knew this was dangerous, you signed up to this, so don't come to us looking for compensation if you injure yourself, okay? If there's consent on the plaintiff, that can be a defence that the defendant can go with, okay?
Yeah, but Paul, just for example, in something like that, even though you sign a disclaimer or whatever before you do a parachute jump, what if the equipment was faulty that company were using and you weren't aware that the equipment was faulty?
Yeah, that's possible. So, the burden of proof would kind of vary, but that's a good example of where the burden of proof actually may shift. So it might be up to you to prove the equipment was faulty. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think I'd say with pretty much all of them, you would have to prove that the equipment was faulty. Yeah. If you injure yourself and you go into court and you say, well, I did the parachute jump, I injured myself, and you don't mention anything about equipment or negligence or somebody didn't do what they were supposed to do, if you don't mention any of that, you're not going to win. Okay, guaranteed you're not going to win. Okay? Fourth one is inevitable accident. Okay? Sometimes accidents happen, no matter how, no matter what precautions you take. Okay, there's a case here. It's an old case. It dates back to the 1890s. There's a case here, Stanley versus Power, where the defendant fired the gun at a pheasant. The bullet ricocheted off a tree and injured the plaintiff. Okay. Sometimes, you know, there's not really any realistic thing you could do to protect from that happening. Okay. Sometimes accidents happen, and it can just be the plaintiff's tough luck that it did happen. Okay. If the accident happened because there was water on the floor and you didn't mop up the water, yeah, you could have mopped up the water and the plaintiff wouldn't have fallen, okay? Something like that, where it's case, okay, a bullet hits a tree and then another tree and somehow hits the plaintiff, there's very little that can be done to take precautions from that, okay? And finally, necessity, okay? There's two more. Necessity, first of all. Best example of necessity is CPR, okay? If you ever did a CPR course, you will probably be warned that you can break somebody's ribs by doing CPR, okay? But if you do not take the action of taking CPR, what can happen to the person? The person can die, okay? So yes, you broke the person's ribs, but they survived because you did CPR on them, okay? There have been cases where people sue because of that, okay? Final one is statute of limitations, okay? You have 3 years to bring forward a case, all right? Can't wait forever and say, okay, now I'm a bit down on my luck, I want money, I'm going to sue for that accident that happened 20 years ago.
You can do it once they reach the age of 18.
Say that again?
Unless in the case of a minor, you haven't, once if they reach the age of 18, you can then...
Sue at the age of 18, yeah. Okay. Just be clear, there were two parts to that question. I only covered the second bit. Okay, so the first bit was what you need for negligence, but it sounds like you're all comfortable with that. Second bit was on the defences. Okay, it was all one question, but it's kind of rolled into It's not officially a two-parter, but it basically is a two-parter. Okay. So the last ones. So we're now in question 8, and then we'll move on to the real exam. So in terms of question 8 has a number of different categories in it. So it's a number of different legal terms. Okay. And you have to explain what they mean, okay? So the first one is, I'll just quickly run through them, then I'll go back and explain what they mean. First one is obiter dictum. Second one is the literal rule. Third one is caveat emptor. Fourth one is invitation to treat. And the last one is ultra vires. Okay? So there is exactly the same, it's not necessarily the same terms, but there's exactly the same question on the real exam, okay? So five legal terms from various parts of the legal course, briefly explain what they are, okay? So obiter dictum, first of all, comes from judicial precedent, okay? So basically, what is obiter dictum? It basically means that when there's a decision made, so it comes from judicial precedent, as we already explained, means that if a court had... last year, if a court had the same facts in front of it and made decision X is binding unless the facts are different. Okay, so what you have there is you have what is known as ratio decidendi, which is reason for the decision. Okay, the court will explain. The court just won't just make a decision and then walk out. They will explain the reason for the decision. The reason for the decision is known as ratio decidendi. There is, however, also things that they say which do not influence the decision, and that is obiter dictum, okay, which means by the way, okay. The judge will talk quite a bit when they're making the decision. They will give reasons for the decision, but they will also say other things as well. The rest of the judgment is obiter dictum. It just basically means you can't go and randomly, you can't take things out of context, just randomly pick them and say, well, a judge in that case said X, Y, Z, therefore it's binding on a different case, okay. The judge may have said X, Y, Z, but they only said it in passing. It was not key to their decision. Okay? That's what obiter dictum means. All right? Second one's the literal rule, which comes from the sources of law in Ireland. Okay? And the part on statutory legislation. Okay? So, the literal rule basically means that judges must give words that their literal or usual meaning means when they're talking. Okay? So, I mean, there's a couple of examples. I mean, the best thing to do is cover a couple of examples. There's one example there, which is the Inspector of Taxes versus Kiernan. The Supreme Court was required to consider whether the expression cattle in the Income Tax Act of 1967 included pigs. Okay, so somebody trying to say, you know, cattle were exempt from something under income tax. in the Income Tax Act of 1967. Somebody tried to claim, oh, well, cattle, I raise pigs, therefore I'm exempt as well. Okay? So the literal, and obviously they did not succeed, because the literal rule, most people would interpret cattle, you stop someone, again, like the officious bystanders test, you stop someone in the street, you say, what is cattle? They will say cows. All right? They won't mention pigs. Okay? So that's the literal rule. Okay? It literally is the rule. Okay? Caveat emptor is the third one. Comes from the Sale of Goods Act, okay? Caveat emptor quite simply means let the buyer beware, okay? If you're buying something, it is your job to have a quick look at it and decide you're happy with it before you buy it, okay? Okay. Fourth one is invitation to treat, which comes from contract law. So an invitation to treat basically means it's an offer to receive offers, okay? When Tesco opened their doors at 7 o'clock in the morning, all the stuff they have on the shelves is an invitation to treat, okay? It's not an offer yet, okay? When you bring the stuff to the till, that's you offering to buy it, okay? Then you give money, which is your consideration. You know, they accept it. When they accept the money that you hand over, which is your consideration, then you have a contract, all right? So invitation to treat is sticking stuff up on shelves and offering for offers, okay? Same if you start advertising something, okay? And finally, you have ultra vires, which comes from company law, okay? So ultra vires basically means, companies will have what are known as memorandums and acts and articles of association. In those memorandums and articles of association, they will say, we are a company and we are going to do the following, okay? All right, we're a company and we're going to sell crisps, okay? They can't suddenly then go to the bank and say, actually, we want a loan, we're going to go buy cars instead. It's ultra vires if they do that, okay? It's fine if they amend the articles of association and say, actually, we're not going to sell crisps and we're not going to sell cars, but until they do, it's ultra vires. It's outside of the company's powers to do that, okay? Okie doke. So that's how you answer the questions, okay? That's how you answer the, so we have the mock exam, that's how you answer the questions, all right? So we'll now look at the real exam. I'll give you some pointers which allow you to narrow down what you cover off in the real exam, okay? How are we doing for time? We've got about 10 minutes. So the real exam. So question one comes from module one, okay? And it's very similar to the one in the mock exam. So let me go back to the similar one on the mock exam. So it comes from module one. Yeah, well. So it comes from module one, and it's the sources of Irish law, okay? So module one is basically divided into two parts. You have the sources of Irish law, okay, which explains the history and how our legal system works in Ireland, and then you have the contract law as the second part. Okay. Okay. So this is from the sources of Irish law, module one. Okay. And the question that was in the mock exam, but this is very similar to what's in the real exam. Question in the mock exam is outline, so just repeat it, is to outline and briefly describe the primary sources of law in Ireland. Okay? So there is a very similar one to that on the real exam. Okay? So question one on the real exam is a two-parter. Okay? First part is worth 20 marks. Second part is worth 5 marks. Okay? So the 20 mark one, very, very similar to what you have on the mock exam, okay? Second part is worth 5 marks. And basically, you know, you do remember on the when we looked at the mock exam a few minutes ago, we were asking the question, what is the difference between civil law and criminal law? It's a very similar question. It's explained the difference between, but it is not civil and criminal law. There's another way of dividing the laws, okay? That's what it's asking. If I remember correctly from the notes, that's, if it's not one, it's the other, all right? So have a look back at the notes. Module one, sources of Irish law, explain the difference between two different types of law. It's not civil and criminal, okay? That's worth 5 marks, okay? So first part, very, very similar to the question in the mock exam. Second bit, 2 types of law, not criminal or civil, but a different way of dividing them. I want to take my time on this to make sure you have every possible advantage. So are there any questions on that? Do you need me to repeat any of that? Okay. Question 2, okay? It's also from Module 1, and it's from the other part of the module. It's on contract law, okay? So, again, it's very similar to the one in the mock exam. So I will repeat the one in the mock exam. The one in the mock exam, question in the mock exam was explain the essential elements of a contract, okay? So I'll go a step further and tell you it's basically the same question, but it's asked a different way. Same answer for the mock would pretty much do for the real one. Okay? 20 marks available for that. Okay? The whole lot will add up to 100, okay, when you get to the end of this one. I know there's a difference, we have a little bit of tidying up to do on the mock one, but I know the mock one's a bit different. But
what you're saying, question 2, part A, it's very similar to the mock.
Sorry, very similar to the contract, not question 2 on the mock, very similar to the contract question on the mock exam, okay? That is question
3.
It's actually question 3 on the mock, yeah. It's important to clarify that. Okay. So that's 20 marks, okay, so that's the main guts of it. The second part is worth 5, okay? So I'll just explain how you narrow that bit down. Okay, so when you go through the contract piece, okay, you have your offer, your acceptance, you have a consideration, you have your intention to create legal relations. That's the main thrust of what's in the contract module, but there is stuff afterwards, okay? All right, now in the mock exam, we covered off terms of a contract. We did express terms, implied terms, okay? You can forget about that, okay? So it's like that, but it's not that one, all right? All right, so you have your offer, your acceptance, you have all that, okay? Then you have stuff after that section, okay? Including your express and your implied terms, okay? It's not that section, it's one of the others, okay? You can leave out, in terms of leaving stuff out, there's a section there on damages, so you can leave that out, cross it off, you don't need it. And there's also some case studies in there as well, okay? You can leave out the case studies as well, yeah. Okay? Now, a bit of good news for you. So once again, staying on the contract piece, okay? So you go through your offer, you go through your acceptance, consideration, and your intention to create legal relations, okay? So the stuff after that, That'll allow you to answer the small part of question 2, but it will also allow you to answer all of question 3. Okay, so even if you don't even study up your offer, your acceptance and all that, you just study the rest of the contract bit afterwards, it'll allow you to answer the final part of question 2, but also all of question 3. Okay, so for a relatively small number of pages, you get a question and a bit. Okay? So question 3, just in terms of the structure, it's a two-parter. It's 15 points for the first part, 10 for the second. So we'll take as much time as we need. Is there any questions on that bit? So that's question 1, question 2, and question 3. Nope? Okay. Question 4. Question 4 comes from company law, okay? Company law is module 2. It comes from company law. And it's a tricky enough question, so I'm going to narrow it down for you. It's on insolvency, okay?
Question 4 is all on?
Question 4 is, it's a one-parter, so you have 25 marks for the whole lot. It's on insolvency.
Okay.
It's a slightly tricky question, but if you study it up well, you could certainly do it. So it's on insolvency. Okay. Question 5 also comes from module 2, which is company law. Okay? So it's a two-parter. There's 20 points available for the first bit and 5 available for the second. Okay? The first part is very similar to the question on the mock exam. Now let me just give you which number that is, and I'll repeat the question for you. So the question that we did on... it's question 4 from the mock exam. So just to repeat what that question was. Question was, explain how a private limited company differs from that of a sole trader. Okay? It's a very, very, very similar question on the main exam. So we're on question 5 on the main exam. It's very similar to question 4 on the mock exam. Okay? Okay, so that's your 20 marks, okay? Now in terms of your 5 marks at the end, it again comes from company law, so we're not mixing and matching. Again comes from company law. I'll say to you, it's an area you'll know well if you work in credit management, okay? You could answer it even without studying the notes. Okay, that's question 5. Question 6 comes from EU law. Okay. All right, so module 3 is EU law. Okay. In the EU, there's a number of institutions. Okay, there's the Commission, there's the Council of Ministers, there's the Parliament, and there's the ECJ. Okay. All right. So your main part of that question, so again, that's 20 marks and then 5 at the end. So, but the main part of that question is about one of those institutions. Okay? So it's either the Commission, Council of Ministers, the Parliament, or the ECJ. Okay? And the second one is basically, I mean, I'll more or less give you the second one. I mean, it's basically how is EU law enforced upon Ireland, okay? There's 5 marks available for it, so you won't spend a lot of time on it. It's a short paragraph, it do. Okay? Question 7. My guidance on question 7 is nice and short, okay? So it can basically be summarized in 3 words, okay? Review your assignment. Okay? You know your assignment well. Look at your assignment. Look at any comments I gave you in terms of the assignment. If you know your assignment well, you'll be fine on that question. This is on tort, okay?
3 words.
My 3 words is review your assignment. If you want a 4th word, review your tort assignment. Okay? If you know it well, you will be fine on question 7, okay? So that's very easy. You wrote it yourself, okay? So you're basically regurgitating stuff you already did, okay? And then finally, question 8. So question 8 is the same as the mock paper, okay? So 5 bits, 5 legal terms, okay? And you need to explain them, okay? Okay? And it's equal marks for each.
Cite a case.
Sorry, say that again?
It says there's a and cite a relevant case.
Sorry, we're on question...
8. So for each of the 5... You have to cite a case.
Cite a relevant case or provide an example, okay? I would lean more towards the second bit. Yeah, or provide an example, yeah. Yeah. So yeah, exactly the same wording is there on the main one, yeah. So I mean, your general guidance I give you guys, I mean this wouldn't just apply to question 8, but to all of it is, you know, show me you understand what you're writing, you know. I can theoretically go off and learn a page of quantum physics and regurgitate in an exam, but it doesn't mean I have a clue what it does, what it means. If you can prove that you know what it means as you're going along, you'll get a higher set of marks. Okay. So in terms of so that's question 8, but I'll narrow it down a bit more for you. So let me see. So first of all, so there's 5 there on the main paper. 2 of them are on the mock paper. Okay. So let me remind you what's on the mock paper. So on the mock paper, we have obiter dictum, we have the literal rule, we have caveat emptor, we have invitation to treat, and we have ultra vires. Okay, two of those are on the real paper. Okay. And I'll narrow it down for me a little bit more. You do remember I mentioned obiter dictum earlier. If you read that area, I'll help you a bit more. It's not ratio descendi, okay? But there is another Latin term in that little bit. You'd do well to, if you want to answer that question, you'd do well to find that one. All right? Okay. So that's a hint on one of them. Two of them are there. Okay. So two of them are exactly the same. All right. So we know them from the block paper. You have on the real one, okay? What other guidance would it give you out of the rest of them? You'll know one of them, okay? Because it's from tort. All right, so you'll know one of them, and then the last one, in terms of where it's from the Principles of Law, Module 1, okay? And you could actually probably, you know, just by using common sense, you could probably even answer it even if you haven't done this course.
Maybe we'll use the source of law.
Yeah, let me go through it again, just because there's a bit of information there. So out of the five, first one, it's not obiter dictum, but I would read around the obiter dictum piece in the notes, okay? The second one is from the Principles of Law, okay? Element of common sense in it. That's the one that you could probably answer even if you didn't do this course, okay? Number three, let me just see. Number three is on the mock paper. Number four is on the mock paper. And number five is from tort. And it's not buried in the mists of time anywhere in the notes. It's a fairly easy one. So let me see, any kind of final things I'll say to you. So I mean, what's in the notes, you know, you don't need to read anywhere outside the notes, okay, other than maybe your own assignments, okay, which I've given you guidance on. So I would have a look at those, particularly in one case. What else would I say? The notes are more than enough to get you comfortably a pass or beyond. Most of you have scored well in the assignments, so that'll boost your marks further. If you're really going for top marks, okay, there are times where I email back assignments and I say, good news, you got 95%, and somebody comes back to you and says, can you tell me where I lost the five? That's fine. If you are shooting for those type of marks, what I would say is you'd probably need to provide just something a little bit different to what maybe your colleagues are. I mean, as Declan said, we look at all the ones together, all the twos together, all the threes together. So if you want to come out top out of the four or five or six people who did that question, you'll need to add something different that the others have not put in, okay? It's not the assignments, okay? So keep that in mind. You have a week to do the assignments. You have half an hour to do these, okay? So don't try and replicate the assignments, okay? Case law is good. A lot of the questions don't necessarily lend themselves to a lot of case law, but things like tort and things like contract, there's case law in there. You won't lose marks by not putting them in, but you will gain marks if you do put them in. So it'd be no harm to come in armed with a couple of cases. Don't worry too much about the dates, you know, as long as you know the general order. If you're answering, you know, I'll be honest, there isn't a history type question in the main exam, unlike the mock one. But if you are focusing on dates, you know, have the order kind of right, but you don't necessarily need to have it nailed to the actual year. Are there any further questions that you may have? I'll look to see what happened in terms of the mock paper. I'll email it out again to everybody again anyway, just to make sure you all have it, okay? If it's of any help to you. So you have that. You will have the link, according to Declan. Declan's going to send out the link to the actual to what I'm recording here. So you know, if you want to combine the two to match things up. But I think the most important stuff you will have learned is probably in the last kind of 15-20 minutes or so on the real paper. All right. Won't be here on the day. Declan will be here, but I will be doing the corrections, and we'll turn them around week 10 days or so, week or 10 days or so to get them done, and then Declan does the admin stuff and it goes back out to you. Okay.
Well, would you say to, as a general overall, module 1 and module 2 would pretty much cover all? Or?
Very good question. Let me see. Module 1 would give you question 1, so that's 1. It would give you question 2. Our contract is in there as well, so that would give you question 3. It won't give you question 4, won't give you question 5. You could do module 1, and you could read your tort assignment. It's not about me, but I kind of like it when I get a variety of different questions across the group. But listen, if all of you want to do exactly the same 4 questions, that is your business. You're certainly entitled to do that. So module 1 could get you 3, and your tort assignment, which you've all written yourselves, as I said, would get you another 1. So yeah, you could. Good question. Any other questions? Okay. I do owe, is Dervla here?
No.
Okay. I do owe Dervla 1 assignment back. Other than that, I've returned every assignment that I have received. So if there are any outstanding, I can still take them up until the gun is fired on the exam. Okay. After that, I'm into correction mode for the exams, and Declan wants them turned around nice and quick, and I want to give the time to the exams to make sure that I give you the marks that you deserve as well. So I can't be doing assignments while I'm doing the exams, but up until, even in your own case, up until the 9th of September, I can certainly accept assignments. So I will still correct any that you're missing, all right? Hopefully you have them all done by now, but if you don't, I'll still accept them, all right? Other than that, I wish you the very best of luck.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.